But he does break it up into parts, because he talks about how the person returns to the earth, and then he talks more, and then he says the dust returns to the earth. So he seems to be segmenting, and I just want to get more of a handle on where he's going. But you have to do the commentaries on it, because the literal read, again, is going to be very... I didn't see anybody really take it that way. You know, speaking of Sforno and Ibn Ezra and Rashi. So all the different things about that he's referring to, the sun and the moon and the stars, and they dim and the clouds return. So do you all have English commentaries on any of those Rishonim, like Sforno or Ibn Ezra, or no? Okay, look those over thoroughly. Do it to the end of the book. But he's talking initially about how a person's faculties start to wane. But he's doing it, there's a number of questions why he's doing, you know, he's very descriptive, and he's also doing it in a metaphoric fashion. But just to start, I'll just make one note. When he starts at the beginning and he says that the sun, the moon, the stars start to dim. So some give a different metaphor on what it's alluding to, but you know, like the rabbis say, that you can't have a verse interpreted that's against its plain meaning. So there has to be some plain meaning why he used the sun, the moon, the stars, the entire universe. So just as a starting point, it would seem to me that the reference to the greatest objects in the universe becoming dim is because this is a person's universe. That is his sense of what's real. So it seems to me he wants to paint a very real picture and make it very real to the person, because this is all going on in the words in the beginning of chapter 12, that you should remember your creator in the days of your youth. And if, meaning to say, if you didn't do it in your infancy, then it, at least when you get mature, as one of the commentaries said, don't think that it's too late. He talks about a silver cord breaking later on, like verse 7 or 8, somewhere around there. So he's referring to silver, meaning either your spine, or meaning gray hair, meaning that a person should still strive when he's older. But he starts off this whole introduction here about trying to wake the person up before it's too late. So you see, he clearly is speaking to what, Doug, you touched on last week about immortality. That the reason why you have to address a person at this point is because the person will be, he'll deceive himself, and he won't want to face the fact that this life is coming to an end. It's something a person pushes off. So he feels it's very important that this should be, you know, this should be a reality that a person recognizes. I'm not sure why he goes to the metaphor. Maybe it's something which, at the end of the book, he actually says that King Solomon wrote many metaphors in order to find words that were desirous to people. Meaning, sometimes you can't just say something openly, or sometimes something won't register as real. But if you use a metaphor, the purpose of using metaphor is to speak within the perspective of the listener. There's a certain, you know, what is familiar to the person? That's what you have to use to start breaking new ground with the person. You can't just start talking about a new area with new terminology that a person has no idea what the words mean. So if you want to teach somebody about a concept of, for example, like Moses was telling Paro at the end of the plague of hail, that the stiff plants broke, because the hail came down and broke the stiff plants. But the soft plants, though, were not yet fully ripe, they weren't hard yet, so they were flexible, so they bent, they bounced back. So he was trying to speak to Paro's obstinacy by saying, if you're going to be behaving like a stiff plant, so you're going to be broken. So he used a metaphor that related to concepts that are already in his reservoir of knowledge, his area of familiarity. So when you speak about the sun and the moon and the stars dimming, in this case, so you're using something which a person recognizes as his sense of what's real. So you start to talk about these things dimming, it can now register on what a person looks at as being his sense of reality, meaning here, his earthly stay. He can start to come to terms with the fact that there is a limit, there is an end to it. So it could be that's why he starts with that. But like I said, I want to go through it more in order to really have, I don't want to just speak of the first couple of verses, which I saw the commentaries, but I want to see how it fits in with this entire, it seems to be about this three areas to the last part. There's this first part about the body, he refers to like a, like he says when the grinders are no more. So the grinders are referred to as being the teeth, when your teeth stop working, because there's very few of them, it says in the verse. Or if the warriors are stooped over, they're hunched over. So he gives an image of a person who's typically strong, but now he's stooping over. So he's trying to register on the person that this parts of your body too are sort of like warriors to you. And they take different parts, the body, the liver, the eyes, like the people looking out of the windows, they stop looking out of the windows, meaning the eyes have become clouded, you can't really physically see so well. So he's painting a picture of what really happens. A person doesn't really face this until, unfortunately, he's actually experiencing it, but he's trying to give foreknowledge to a person, but all for the sake of what he said at the beginning of 12:1. You should remember your Creator when you still have the ability. And in order to drive that home, he talks about what the inevitabilities of the physical condition are. But he breaks it up into two parts. He talks about the first couple of verses, and then before you return to the earth, and the mourners are circling on the streets, and then he goes back and he talks about this silver cord and a gold pot or something, some sort of an object. And he's using these euphemisms. And the pitcher is broken, and the wheel is smashed in the pit. And then the dust returns to the earth from where it came, meaning the person's body. And then the spirit, the wind, goes back to God, meaning accountability. So there he talks about another segment in terms of the person's end of days. And then he starts talking about himself, that King Solomon wanted to set up all of these metaphors in order to be, you know, to that people should listen and think about them. And the words of the wise, they're like, you know, driven nails. They're really solid. They're things which are very penetrating. There's a lot of aspects to that metaphor too. So, you know, look through that. But we'll do something other today. We'll do something on the Parsha. I saw something which I thought would be very interesting. But I'm just giving some inroads, which I'm just sharing that I've seen. And hopefully that can be some sort of a structure in terms of how we'll approach these last, seems to be, three segments. All right? So, a little bit of research to do over the weekend, if you can. But, you know, go through the end. And, you're going to have to probably go through it a few times. But, again, if you can get a hold of the Ibn Ezra, there's some good material there. Sforno is very good on this. So if you have Sforno, and just, become familiar with and see if you can start structuring for yourself where these three areas are, like I mentioned. Because he talks twice about returning to the earth. So if he talks about returning to the earth, why does he go back and discuss other things and then say again return to the earth? Evidently, he's categorizing. There's two different areas. And then his final piece on what he was doing, his little bit of biography on what his purpose was with this and what his goal was with the book. Okay?
Rabbi?
Yes.
We're theoretically kind of lost without the commentators on this. What did people do before the commentators?
Yeah, good question. My guess is that you had the sages, the rabbis throughout time that had an understanding of where he was going with this, because you see that he doesn't leave you completely relying on commentators, because the beginning of 12 says that you should remember certain things before, you know, while you're still young. And then he says before the sun and the moon and all these things gather. So he's telling you that this entire description about before all this and before all that is a description of your state when you're younger, as opposed to when you get older. So right there you see that he's giving you a direction, that it's a description about the comparison of the person's when he's younger as opposed to when he's older. And the only difference is the body. There may be some attitudes also. Like he says, until the days come, the evil days where you say, I have no desire. So there's certain psychological changes too. But he doesn't leave you without direction. You see?
So it's like the way the Talmud worked, that it was handed down, the Mishnayos, they were handed down generation to generation until they had to write it down. So same thing here is, it's written down now, but previous to this, everybody handed it down generation to generation. This is Moses and David that wrote this?
No, King Solomon wrote Kehelis.
Okay.
These are all King Solomon's words.
Alright, so he handed it down to his children. God would hand it down to him, and so on.
Well, King Solomon wrote this. He originated this, but it still is divinely inspired, so it's all 100% true. But he wrote something, this book, Kohelis, Ecclesiastes, to address a person's philosophy on life. And when he's finally concluding, he's finally trying to give a very penetrating message of don't wait till it's too late. And what Doug was asking was, before we had the commentators, how do we really know if it's so essential to, like I'm saying, it's hard to understand it.
Knowledge.
What's that?
It should be common knowledge for the people, like let's say Peretz, that we learned in the Parsha, you know, that Peretz was born, it was 10 generations till David, something like that. So they knew this as knowledge, and they just handed it down to their children, until Solomon and David put it into writing.
Well, again, this was originated with King Solomon, this book. So the specifics that's in this book, I mean, the central ideas, everybody who was intelligent knew. They knew that immortality was false. They knew that certain things change with age, and that there's a severity about the temporal duration of human life. It's a real severe matter. Now he's saying it very clear here.
Generations going back to the actual...
No, the
previous... Or
Sinai. Well, I mean, in terms of who's closer to God, that's God's equation. I mean, there are, the rabbis do speak about that people, as generations moved on, they became less attached to wisdom and more attached to emotions and money and fame and so on. But the capacity to be like a King Solomon and a Moses, meaning to be a great person, that has not changed. God still creates people that have varying states of potentiality. But Doug's point was that without the commentators, I was saying that it's very hard to understand this. So were people just lost without understanding this book that King Solomon wrote until Sforno came along? So I'm saying no, they weren't lost, because even King Solomon himself, he gives clues as to the direction that he's going in the book. He's, even though he talks about metaphors, but he gives you a hint as to where the area is, even right here, because he says a very literal statement: you should remember your Creator while you're still young, before certain things happen. Now, what that means clearly, before you get older. So then, when he gives all these things about the stars and the sun dimming, that must be euphemistically referring to some aspects of older age. So the rabbis go in and spell it out for us. But to answer Doug's question, it's not that we're completely reliant on, you know, Sforno and people who came, you know, thousands of years later to understand his book. So the people in between when King Solomon wrote Kehelis and when Sforno came around, so what, they were lost? No, they were leaders, they were intelligent people throughout time, and God gives a promise. And we say it at the end of the prayers every day in the morning, that the Torah will not leave your mouth, your children's mouth, or your grandchildren's mouth. That means God will always ensure that there'll be a way, the Torah will be available, and that people that want it, it will be available to them, and they'll be able to get the ideas. He's not going to leave any generation bereft, and he'll make sure that there are people. I mean, you see that God made sure that Moses was there at Egypt at that time. Even Maimonides says that in the end of the first chapter of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry, his laws of idolatry, he says that God created Moses. What does it mean he created? Doesn't he create everybody? No, he created him specifically for that time. And don't you think that it was a coincidence that Abraham arose at the time when the whole world was darkened with idolatry, and there all of a sudden there's an Abraham? Of course he used free will. God wasn't forcing his hand. But you see that God made sure certain people in certain generations. Noah too. Adam also. He didn't make Adam a boar. He made Adam, Ibn Ezra says, was a great intellect.
Someone today who could drill into the general public that money is not important and materialism is not important.
Yeah, listen, there's plenty of yeshivas, there's plenty of people out there. But the people have to listen too.
They need it to be broadcast to the billions. We need to set up a fund, we need to set up an organization to take on this goal.
All right. Sounds like a good plan.
And we need to do it now! Okay,
sorry for interrupting. All right. Your enthusiasm is good.
Thank you, Rabbi. Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
We have, as I understand it, proof of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. You mentioned that King Solomon's work here was inspired by God.
Yes.
We know that.
Good question. Well, I think that as a leader and one who understands what is going to be incorporated into one of the three areas, meaning the Torah or prophets or writings, that he would be following that principle. I think all the rabbis too that were in his time and afterwards, immediately subsequent, they would only allow something to be considered part of writings because it did fit the bill. So King Solomon teaching the truth must have communicated the truth that this was divinely inspired, and the wisdom had to be attested to by those who saw his words. In addition, I think that God's will, that the Torah has a certain corpus, will be not to allow things to become Torah if they really are not. So there's a number of arguments you can use. I haven't seen anything written by the rabbis themselves. Not that it's not written, it's just that I haven't been fortunate enough to see what their principles are, but I would say that they... these things are accurate. Yeah, are you going to say something?
Yeah, good morning. This is Nachshon. I was going to say, I think Devarim, look at the Deuteronomy, spells out, and we can apply it probably in this case here, in terms of how do you recognize somebody being a false prophet? And I think we can use Shlomo HaMelech's words, but basically comparing, if it's anything that falls contrary to Torah, that basically you don't follow it. I mean, if the words are leading us to follow a different God that we were not used to, or not taught by Torah, we know it's false. And so, like you alluded to what you were saying before, as far as the rabbis were able to measure these different words and different books, the canon of the Tanakh, and come to a conclusion that certain books were inspired. And so, I think that's what our guide is. The other thing is too, like yesterday's Haftorah portion. Towards the end, talks about that Hashem, always uses prophets to reveal his secrets, and so I think, the Torah and Tanakh, that's our guide, and basically Hashem never leaves us, blind to say without some form of guidance, either through the Torah or the rabbis of our generation that we're supposed to go to for answers.
Well, that would be in terms of prophecy. This is different. Meaning something that's divinely inspired is not necessarily occurring through a prophecy. There are different levels of inspiration. Maimonides talks about it. Like he even says, the person who's moved to lead others, that's somewhat of divine inspiration. He says that in his guide.
But you can imagine whether somebody's words are in line with the Torah.
Right, but it's be hard to distinguish between a very wise work and a wise work which was divinely inspired. That's what Doug is really asking. What proof do we have that's on par with the revelation at Sinai? There's an absolute proof in terms of that those words came from God. Right, you had, and even the words that weren't written at Sinai yet, because that was only up to the middle of the book of Exodus. What about all the rest of the Torah that Moses wrote down subsequent to Sinai? How do we know that that was something which was really divinely inspired in that Moses' own writing? So that we can answer. I believe that's the miracle of Moses' face shining, that there was a miraculous light that emanated from him, and he always kept a veil. Now, God would not endorse somebody with his miracles if he was fabricating his own words and trying to pass them off as Torah. So there we have, I think, pretty solid, but I think we dug, you know, proof that that the entire Torah is directly from God. But Doug is asking, what specifically do we have that's on par with Sinai that we can say that the words of King Solomon are divine, are purely his, are purely God's ideas and not his own subjective views? So, I mean, I'll stick with what I said, but I definitely will look into this more, because it is a very, very important and valid question. Because to give the appreciation, this would apply to anything. Like the Megillus Esther, the story of Esther, that whole letter. So it's important that we have the true appreciation in order to give it the due study that, you know, God's inspirational words deserve. But I'll look into it, Doug. Yeah, sure. Okay. Let's see. I'm just debating whether to do a little bit more on this since we started already. And we might as well. I mean, well, I guess we'll do it. Let me just get the copy. Hold on.
I can do something on the Chumash, but we already started. So while our head is in it, maybe it's beneficial to continue.
Okay. That's so, like I said, so we're in the beginning of 12. How's the sound? Can you hear me well from there? Okay. Maybe let's move a little bit closer here. Right now. So you see that he says in the beginning of 12, you should remember your creator, 12:1. Remember your creator in the days of your, of when you're not just an infant, but when you're, you know, infant, but you've gotten a little older. As you're older, as you're a bachur, you know, you're a matured individual. Until, meaning remember him, and like we said, follow him properly when you still have all your strength, because as we said last week and the week before, that to refrain from sin because you just don't have the physical capacity is nothing like a person who refrains when he's in his full, you know, capacity and he has all his desires and then he holds himself back. That's a real person who, you know, conquers his spirit. So he's saying that a person should make sure he does this before the days of evil come. And he reaches the years that he says that he has no desire. All right, so that's very straightforward. This is really where the practical benefit of perfecting yourself. We only have one opportunity just to add severity to this matter. So there's one opportunity here. And we're all still, thank God, healthy. We have, you know, we're still in our full strength. So to repent and to be focused on what's most important, because it is temporary, and the years are going. And this is what King Solomon is trying to stress over here. And he goes on to verse 2, and he says, before the sun and the moon and the stars and the light become dark, and the clouds return after the rain. So Ibn Ezra just says, it's many things he says, but it's all one idea. So So you ask, what's the need to mention all these different things? He says, what is the need for him to mention the light and the moon and the stars? These existences that were created. But he says, this is just the manner of how the Torah speaks. For example, he says that God does not become like tired and he doesn't sleep. What do you have to say, right? Two of them. I mean, there's like, you know, a person is like, you know, falling to sleep, and then there's a state of sleep. So there's two different words in Hebrew for that. So why do you have to say both? So he's saying this is just the way the Torah speaks. It emphasizes, it repeats. It wants to drill an idea home. There's no sleep, and there's not even any slumber. Meaning there's no quality of tiredness at all before God. So that's how the Torah brings that out. So when you want to say over here that you should repent, you should live properly and do what's right before your world goes dark. So he uses all the different aspects of the world, the daytime, the sun and light, nighttime, the moon and the stars. Okay, but as I'm suggesting, why does he use it in the metaphor? Because he's trying to reach what a person's sense of reality is. And a person's sense of reality, which is specifically, precisely why he's writing about this here, a person's reality is rooted in the physical. So King Solomon here takes those things which are most physical, most depict his sense of what the world is, all those things in heaven. But then he moves on to more of a cryptic description. And he says, let me just finish what Sforno says. He says, Sforno refers, he says, before the light dims, meaning your life, your spirit of life. And what is the moon? The moon is your brain that receives all sense perception. And what are the stars? Sforno says, these are the senses themselves. Smelling, touch, taste, and all the internal senses too. All right. And the clouds returning means that they blind all light. Clouds stop all light from coming through. So he's painting a picture. He's trying to make it real to a person. And he says, and he continues, and he says, you should, before all that happens, and before the next verse happens too, the day that the guards of the house, the watchers of the house, will tremble, and the warriors will stoop over, they'll get hunchbacked, and all of the grinders will cease, because they become few, and they'll cease to be those who look out of the windows. So now he's a little bit more cryptic, but like we said, the commentators refer, a number of them say, he's referring to the person's body, whether it's his joints, the shomrei, the people who guard the house, the joints, the ligaments, the bones, and the before the grinder ceases. So what's the part of the body that does the grinding? The teeth. And you see that it says in the verse, because they come few. So you see, a number of the rabbis said this referring to teeth, but you see why? Because Solomon's giving you a hint. What becomes few when you get older? Your teeth. That you lose your teeth. You don't lose limbs. And then the eyes become dim. So but you see that he's trying to give you a picture about how the body is going to start failing. This is just a natural course for everybody. There's no escape. Unless, of course, a person dies suddenly when he's young. But when you don't have your faculties, then you can't perform what you've been placed here to do. And this will happen. And he moves on to verse, let me just see if this one says more details on this. Yes.
Are there any verses about other similarities, like the flowers will not bloom or something like that? Or does it just go on with this is the basic idea and we kind of get the point?
Well, he talks about different aspects, not just the physical, but psychological too, which he's going to come on to in the next two or three verses. You mean to say, like, you know, things that are happiness, things that a person gets joy from, start to diminish too?
Well, like you said, the teeth or the senses, the nose, or thinking, like things become confused, or the path is not straight anymore, or something like that. That also things that happen when you start to age.
Yeah. Well, he talks about here that... Sforner says about looking out the window, he says that even some of your openings will start to become painful or will hold back. So a person, maybe he gets to a point where he's so old he has a hard time swallowing. And he says further, like, what is verse 4? He says the doors will close, right, in the marketplace. And then again he says, so that's talking about that his mouth. Right?
Yeah, makes sense.
Yep. Okay, that's a Sforno.
Well,
he doesn't go into it yet. Let's see what he says. Yeah, Sforno and Ebenezer both say that the door is closing, meaning the lips. To chew is one of them. That's the teeth.
Okay, the same. Right.
Okay. And Rashi says that the door is closed means that his arteries or his intestines or they start to not function. But he's all talking here about physically. He's trying to tell a person again that you start becoming weak physically. Then he talks about, his first verse, in 3 he says that the grinders will cease because they are few. Now he says in 4, when the dims, or there's lower the sound of the grinders. Okay. Let me see if this is not. Right, the sound, I guess, of chewing is what it means. And then it says, now it moves on to something else. Now it says, and he rises at the sound of a bird. And all daughters of song cease. If I'm saying something which is different than what you have in your verses, you let me know in the English, all right? But he says here that, now he says a person will rise up at the sound of a bird. So one commentator says that since he's not going to be able to eat, and eating is something which helps a person have a solid state of sleep, so since he's not able to eat so much, his sleep is impaired, and he's woken, he's startled by even just a very light sound like a bird. To me, it also could mean that there's a certain amount of anxiety that a person has. A person who's will typically start having a certain dread, a certain fear as he gets older. And different things will startle him much more easily than when he was younger.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Couldn't that also mean that your hearing is going
well? Well, he seems to be hearing the bird fine.
But it says the daughters of
right, so I think that was in terms of his own throat, his ability, meaning the person. Let me see what the Ebenezer said on that again. Yeah, this is the throat, according to Ibn Ezra. All right, so maybe Rashi is saying what you're saying, where he says that there will be they'll come to an end, or they'll be silenced, or they'll become the daughters of song. So he says that all sounds of musical instruments now appear to him as just speech. And he says the implication is, that all officers will become lowered in his eyes. Sounds to me like he's saying that is what he once admired in terms of people of stature, of, you know, status. Now that diminishes too. Interesting statement. It says further that in 5, that also from heights he will be afraid, and he'll have fear on the road. And from the almond blossom and the grasshopper, it'll be like a pain for him. And all his desires will cease, because man is going to his eternal home. And all the mourners will then circle in the streets. So you see, that's where he ends off one segment, I believe, here. So what does he mean that the flower, like a flower blossom, an almond blossom, or the grasshopper, it'll become like a pain? What do you have, a pain, annoyance? What's the word you have there, Doug? That's
verse.
It's verse 5?
Oh, after the grasshopper clause?
Yeah, read the whole verse 5.
This is Jacob Press, and they have also from the high places they will fear, and terrors on the road, and the almond tree will blossom, and the grasshopper will drag itself along, and sexual desire will fail. The man goes to his everlasting home, and the mourners go about in the street.
Yeah, according to Sforno, it says that but the grasshopper will be like a burden, meaning such a light insect will be a burden because he is so weak. And of course, yeah, the sexual desires will fail. But you see, the reasoning is more of a psychological thing, because he knows now the end is coming. Because the man is going to his eternal grave. So since he sees the reality at that part of life, and King Solomon is trying to bring us to that part of life now when we're still young, to focus that will happen. So don't just glide through life and take it easy. Some people have the philosophy, I'll do it later when I have time. No, you're not going to have the strength later. You don't even know how long your life is. But you see, he's talking about psychological now in this verse. He's talking about the physical initially, the body, the sockets, the limbs, right, the orifices, the teeth. But he also talks about how things are a pain psychologically, even small things. He doesn't even want things to stand up. I mean, he's afraid of heights. Heights means just to rise up, according to one view. It's a struggle for the person. Maybe simply to stand or to walk up a few stairs. It becomes something which is so daunting. Right, that's what Ibn Ezra says. He says it's talking about people who get very old, that they don't have the strength to walk up to a few stairs. Or even to go somewhere. To go on the road. That becomes like a toil. The things that we take for granted, just to stand up, to walk up the stairs. So now certain things become just, you know, the most meager activity. And this is all because it's more psychological. It's more because he's faced with, you know, all the attempts, the ambitions, and so on. That's driven by a person's sense of immortality. That's what the Talmud says, that they once, you know, tied up the instincts, you know, euphemistically, as a metaphor. And chickens stopped laying eggs, and, you know, people wouldn't, they had no desire to be ambitious, but a person needs that. A person needs that in life. So that's why we said a number of times that God gave a person a certain sense of permanence in this world. He needs that in order to forge ahead, to have families, to build a home, and so on. But at the same time, there has to be a reality of that this is it's a term that we have here. It's limited. It's a limited stay. See, ultimately it's a balance that we have to have. But you see that he really goes on to paint a very specific picture about the different, you know, maladies and the troubles and things that they're going to be we'll be anxious about. Even the sound of the bird is going to alert us. The sensitivity that we have. You see, a person is very old, they just don't have the vigor. But I would say one caveat, and that is that if a person is living the life of wisdom, where that was always what he saw as being the whole purpose in life, so these things are going to be much more mitigated. Yeah, he may have some problems, he may have physical ailments, he's not going to be a Superman just because he's learning Torah, he's still going to suffer. The physical weaknesses that as the body progresses, but his attitude. You see, it talks about how Moses, how he didn't lose any strength even when he was 120 years old, and how the patriarchs, how they died in good old age, and they had the faculties. So if a person's living properly, number one, God's going to step in more in terms of helping him, in terms of his physical needs, his monetary, his physical health, and so on. But just in terms of his attitude in life, his focus is always on wisdom, and that's something which you see that he doesn't talk about over here as being something which wanes. The rabbis say just the opposite. Od yinubim b'seva, d'sheinim ranim yiyu. They'll be those who are intelligent, they follow the life of Torah, they'll be vigorous and fresh, even in old age. In order to tell that God is perfect and there's no flaw in him, meaning they will be equipped with the strength to continue the message to other people. And they'll be used as an example by God. And since this is clear, this is God's will, why he gave us all intelligence to use it. So we are using it. So of course this is something that he's going to give us an assistance to continue as long as possible.
Rabbi?
Yeah?
Our health, our abilities, our, I don't know,
the ability to do things to help people. If we don't use it for that purpose, is it true that he'll take it away?
It depends on the person's level. We can't calculate when God steps in for a person or when he doesn't. It's a very deep science.
Okay.
It's too simple. It's too much of a simplification to say that.
That is too simplified.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
I was also thinking in terms of money. If somebody is blessed with a good income, and that income could be used to help people, but instead he's very selfish, then is it true that he will stop earning that income? Or
that's the same question.
That's the same question, right? It's in the same category.
But King Solomon does say that another place that God gives, I think we read it here, that he makes it like the people who go after money, he gives them the job of gathering it just to disperse it to those who he wants.
Right.
That's something else there. Yeah, but you're talking about from a punitive measure. You want to know if there's a punitive thing going on, that a person doesn't do something right with a certain thing, will it be taken away? It all depends on many factors.
Yeah.
Which we don't know unless we have the, even in the given case, we don't know all that's going on in the person's mind, or we know nothing what God is doing. So we can't say this unless it's written down in the Torah.
Right, exactly.
But I haven't seen something like that.
Okay.
All right, so why don't we stop here? This is a bit of a mouthful. I think we've got a good introduction, and we've concluded the first part, where he talks about that the person will have this, it'll be such a strain for him, even just an insect, and even to stand up or even to go on the road, these things become a problem to the person, because he knows that he's now going to his eternal home. All right, so that's the end of verse 5. But then he moves on, he still says a little bit more. And you'll see that he says, before the silver cord is snapped, and the gold, gold bowl is broken? Is that what you have? In verse 6, he says,
"The golden fountain is shattered."
The golden fountain. Let's see what it says here.
If the silver cord is the spine, then gold is worth more than silver, so it must be the brain.
Yeah, that's what one of the rabbis say. Very good. Yeah, but what's the need to go into that? He already talked about the physical deterioration.
This is the source of thought.
Right.
Thinking.
Right. So this is more of the elevated function in man. And he says the pitcher is smashed and the wheel is smashed in the pit. Two more things he says in here. No, pitcher, P-I-T-C-H-E-R, I think is what he's talking about. All right, but let's look it over. We'll see that this now he's talking, it seems to be more of an elevated function. But look into that, and you see how he says at the end of it, and it says in 7, and the dust returns to the ground like it was, and the wind or the spirit returns to God that gave it. And then he concludes this part in 8, where he says, "Futility of futilities," says Koheles. All is futile. Right, his famous opening words. And then he gives his conclusion, starting with verse 9. So let's look through for the next Sunday from verses verse 6 through rules for 6, 7, and 8. You could live through the end because it's very, it's very short. There's a few more verses after that. So we actually look through 6 through the end. And see where you see, you know, you just get familiar with that. Let me just see. Well, we're here already on 6. He says, quite a sforno, he says, even in your old age, you should go after your eternal perfection as much as you can before your back breaks. Because the spinal cord is white like silver. That's what he says silver is. Sforno says that the gold is referring to the liver.
If the spine is white, why then would Solomon say silver?
He's saying it's similar, as opposed to yellow, which would be similar to gold. Maybe silver is a praiseworthy thing. It adds value. But you see, it's interesting. Why does he do this? Why does he break this up into two parts? Before you return to your eternal home, and the people are mourning in the street. But then he goes back and he talks about more things in life, and then he says, before your dust returns to the earth. He talks about the conclusion of returning to the ground twice. So my question is why he breaks this up. I just want to make sure that you hear my question on this. Why doesn't he just include the spine and the brain and all this in his depiction of when all the physicality starts to deteriorate? And then, until we finally get to the grave. But you see, he talks about the end differently when he talks about the physical functions, eating and the desires and so on, and all this, and he's frightened at the sound of a... Before he's alerted, he wakes up at the sound of a bird, all these different things. He says the reasoning is at the end of verse 5, because man will go to his eternal home. All right, and he talks about the mourners. After he talks about the spine and so on, I just want to make sure that then he just talks about the substance. Not man anymore, but now it's the dirt, the dust, meaning just purely the physical matter of man returns to the land. And then, but he talks about the spirit returns to God that gave it. He gives a sense of culpability or bringing yourself to judgment. See, he doesn't do that in the first one. So I'm just trying to show you the nuances of how in these two conclusionary verses, one just talks about going to his eternal home. And it still talks about him as man. Meaning the psychological. So when he's talking about all the psychological, he's talking about the physical, the things that a person views in terms of his physical existence. So that's a psychological arena. So therefore he talks about the end in psychological terms. The man is going to his eternal home. But when he talks about the spine, and maybe it is talking about the brain, if that's talking about the higher elements, then it would be good that he says man is really just dust. He doesn't talk about him as man anymore. You see that in verse 7? And the dust will return to the earth. Meaning, what does it really boil down to what you really are? He takes you a step further, and he tries to perfect you as you're reading this. Yeah, I just told you before that man will go to his eternal grave. But now that I've got you accepting that, but let's go a step further. You're really not man. Really, what it comes down to, it's an illusion. You're really just dust.
But the real essence of you is the spirit that goes to God who gave it. So you see the step that he makes? You could talk about man in two capacities. Man in terms of a psychological being, his desires, his abilities physically to do things, to walk, to chew, to move his limbs. So there's the demise of his physical state. So there is referred to as because, in psychological, he won't be able to even stand up anymore or to go on the road or certain things are a toil. Just a move a bug is like a toiling thing. But all that is because of man recognizes that he is now going to go to his eternal home, meaning he's looking at himself in a physical, psychological perspective. There's one way you could talk about man in terms of the man himself, his view, his self-image. So the first thing he does is he tries to get a person to accept that this is limited. And you will. You are a man, but you will eventually go to your eternal home. Still, he talks about it in human terms, in earthly terms. You're a man. You're going to a home, but it's eternal. So he slowly eases the person into the acceptance of the finality of life. But now, once the person can accept that, then he talks about, well, what really are you? You're really just dust. Meaning he tries to strip the person away even further from this illusion. I'm an image. I have a self-image of myself. That's something a person wants to maintain. He wants to project it to other people. And when he can't do things, he can't even stand up, he can't even walk up some stairs anymore. These are all in the arena of earthly accomplishments, things that he's going to do. I can't chew anymore. Desires for the sexual have left me. That's all talking about man in the capacity of a delusion of the earthly psychological state of mind. So he tells the person easily, man, meaning that image you have of yourself, you're going to have an eternal home. But he's using earthly terms because he's slowly getting a person to accept the end. He doesn't shock him all at once. But then he moves on. And he talks about how the end is really going to... He talks about the end a second time. After he talks about the spine and when all functions cease, meaning not no movement at all. I mean, the spine breaks or the brain. And we'll have to see what the other things mean. I mean, the pitcher breaks and the wheel smashes into the pit. What does he mean by that? Let me just take a look since we're here already. Do you have class next, or we have a little bit more time?
We have class later. We have time.
Okay, so let me just take a look. Give me 1 second. This Forna talks about all about in terms of the stomach, the intestines, all these things that cease to work. I mean, all your basic life functions. The inner, not in terms of the limbs and so on, the movement. And let's see Ibn Ezra. Yes, Ibn Ezra says also that the silver cord is the spinal cord. And he says also it's called silver because it's really white. So it's similar in you, even though that something which is white and shiny will basically be silver. Maybe he just means something which is reflective. All right. But like Daryl said, the gold, what was that word, Doug? You had the gulas is zahav. The gold what? It was a bowl, was it a fountain, what was it?
Oh, a fountain, right.
Yes, he says that's the brain. And he calls it gold because of the membrane that's red around it. So I guess you have to be a physician to know that.
Actually, that's a very interesting different interpretation of that.
Yeah, this whole thing is different. It's about history, about Jewish history. These are the words of the Torah.
Well, yeah, but he gets the golden fountain to be the male sexual organs.
Rashi you're talking about?
Yeah.
I have here, Rashi says, and they'll break the gold fountain. These are the words of the Torah. As it says, things which are desirous as gold. Yeah, on the gold fountain. Unless he has another explanation.
Well, mine read, and the golden fountain is shattered. This is the male member which emits a flow of water which flows like a fountain. Like Joshua 15:19, the upper springs.
You sure that's Rashi?
They attributed that to Rashi.
That's a mistake. I don't have it here. Unless he says more than I have in my edition. Yeah, but I like Ibn Ezra's explanation. I mean, it fits like Daryl said, that the gold is really a higher prize thing than the spine, because even though you can't move, you can still think if you have your mind.
What does yours say that Rashi says about the pitcher breaking at the fountain?
The pitcher breaks here. This is the picture of a person named Baruch, the son of Neria. It's talking about something in relationship with Jeremiah, that they were both exiled to Babel, and their learning was interrupted because of the pain of traveling. So that's what the fountain's ceasing meaning, their flow of learning ceased.
Wow. This one reads, this is the stomach which is split and splits upon his death. And they put in brackets Rashi from Ecclesiastes Rabbah.
Oh, so it's Ecclesiastes Rabbah. So that means that there was Ecclesiastes Rabbah is the Medrash, the additional writings of the rabbis on the, because it's not Ecclesiastes. So that means Rashi has another explanation on what the rabbis wrote. There were more commentaries on Ecclesiastes than just we have here. So they compiled that, and they called that Ecclesiastes Rabbah. Just like the Medrash. The rabbis. Like Genesis also, there's Bereshis, and there's Bereshis Rabbah. So Bereshis Rabbah is a collection of rabbi sayings on Genesis. So it's an additional error. So that's probably where it is, Doug. That explains the discrepancy in the Rashi.
Well, they're both good explanations.
Yeah. But sticking with the physical, I think, you know, I just want to be consistent. Let me see what it says here. All right, so he says that the gold fountain, that is the brain, according to Ben Ezra. Right, it doesn't seem to say with the pitcher and the wheel. Let me see if another commentary says on this. Yeah, so another one talks about it as being the physical again. But just loosely, we'll have to go into this more next week, but I would say that this explains now why he says, in terms of the end here, that the dust will return to the earth. Like I'm saying, I want you to see clearly here that he talks about the end in two ways. That a man will go to his eternal home. Right? It's a light treatment in terms of describing what the end is. It allows a person to still retain his earthly terms. Because there he's talking about the earthly, the lesser important, chewing and sex and so on. So there he's talking about the psychological, the self-image of the person, and that he brings a person gently to realize that you're going to go to your eternal home. But again, he still talks about it as man and an eternal home. He's still using earthly terms, not to completely strip the reader here of his hold, his security in the physical world. King Solomon recognizes that. That's why he's writing this entire chapter.
is because a person has such security, and he could be completely, dumbfounded and shocked, and his whole life could be shattered if it's too quick, that he's faced with his own mortality. So he does it gently. But once the person can get it, he can wrap his mind around that, accept his mortality, then he could talk about the demise of the real integral things in life, your spinal column, your brain. And when these things go, so now understand that what you really are is dust. Meaning try to get a hold onto, he's trying to help you lose your grip on the veneer, right? The facades that we live under in terms of being a man and living in this life. If you can realize that you're just dust. So that helps you loosen up the grip on life, and it awakens you more to what you really are. And that is the wind, the spirit that returns to God. That's your real essence. So you see it's a two-step approach he gives you here in terms of leading a person to accept the ultimate reality. And then right after that he says, futility of futilities. These things only had a certain purpose, but they aren't ultimately what the real purpose is. Alright, he goes on, he says, and even more than this, Kohelis was a great wisdom, a great, great wise person. He taught knowledge to the people, right? This is verse 9. And that they should hear and they should analyze. And he arranged many metaphors. Kohelis desired to find words that were desirous to people and to write upright things, matters of truth. And he says that, we can actually read to the end of it, we're already here. He says, the words of Chachamim, the words of the wise are like goads, they're like nails that are hammered in. The master of who gather together of, many writings. What does he mean by that? What do you have there, Doug, on the verse 11? People that the of a shepherd, is that where he has it? Or someone who gathers together many writings from one shepherd?
The words of the wise are like goads and like well-fastened nails with large heads given from one shepherd.
Okay, that's interesting. Well-fastened nails with large heads, given from one shepherd. And he says, more than this, my son, be careful to write many books, for there's no end, and it's a great weariness. You got basar. The end of the matter, after all is heard, God you should fear, and his commands you should guard. Because this is all of man, like we just said. The spirit is really what returns. Everything else just goes to the earth. For all matters, God will bring to judgment. All that is hidden, whether it's good or whether it's evil. And that's how he ends the book. So you see, he goes literal towards the end, but you see he's driving home the point about what the ultimate is.
What's the interpretation of studying much as a weariness of the flesh?
No, not studying much, but I think he said they're writing many books. He says, be careful from writing many books. So there's no end, and it's a weariness of the flesh. He wrote many books. Thousands of metaphors he wrote.
He's talking about... That's interesting. That's a very different interpretation. They're very different.
Well, that's the literal words. Even Rashi on that.
What?
Yeah, go ahead.
What they have here is making more than they, my son, beware. Making many books has no end, and studying much is a weariness of the flesh.
Studying much. Liha Karbi, you got Basar. Let's see what it says here.
Rabbi, are we saying that Shlomo HaMelech wrote many books?
Well, he did.
Yes, but studying is a weariness.
That's what I'm looking up right now.
Yeah, okay.
Let me just see what it says here.
It may be a weariness to the flesh, but a strength to the mind.
He doesn't say that in the verse.
You gotta
stick, you gotta stay with the verse. Typically, the word here, v'lahag harbe, that means like to make sure that the text is correct when you're making many books, to compare texts, like editing, and to go over something, to be exacting. It's a very, very tiresome thing. But they didn't have printing presses, and he was writing things over and over again, and that is something which is a very, very wearing thing. But the question is, why does he mention it here? Why do you have to tell me what this seems to be? A very out of place verse. And more than this, my son, be careful from making many books. There's no end, and it's a weariness of the flesh to be making sure that all the copies are exactly right. That's what I mean, not learning. Learning is a very joyful thing. You can learn to your last days, and it's enjoyable. It gives you a lot of energy. So it's not talking about that. It doesn't say limud. It says v'lahag harbe. What does it say here? Let's see.
Is it from the word hag? To celebrate into the learning, or to gain happiness in the learning?
No, I don't know the word means that. Lihag harbe. Give me 1 second. Proofread, correct texts. Like I said, not learning, but in order to just ensure that he says in this verse to write many books, but part of writing it is a weariness aspect to it, and that is that it
it's very wearisome because you're not moving ahead. It's not refreshing the mind. It's your repetition is something which is a very wearying thing. Why he says it, I don't know. That we have to, but I think it's getting late here. You have a class, so why don't we end it here, and we'll pick up next week on this topic. All right?
Did it mean like the word minhag?
No.
From the same root?
It could be when you just repeat something. It could be. The proofreading is what the actual definition was given here. All right. So everybody have a good week. We'll continue next week, same time. All right? Good for everybody.
Thank you,
everybody.
Have a good week.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.